Well, thank you all so much. What a great honor to be here. And my wife Peggy and I have had three glorious days with John and Linda May in this beautiful town of yours, and just couldn't be happier and more proud to have been invited to be a part of this process. What I want to do is just share with you a sense out of these 32 years of surveys that we've been conducting in Houston, Texas, of all places, that has turned out to be at the center of the transformations of America, how and why the 21st century is a different place than most of us thought it was going to be 15 or 20 years ago. We've been doing these surveys for 30 years, watching the city go into major recession with the collapse of the oil boom, and then recover into a restructured economy and a demographic revolution. And the three great themes I want to touch on as quickly as I can. The main one is, of course, the demographic revolution, but also this nature of this new economy that we're in the midst of today, and how cities now have to struggle to attract the talent of the 21st century by making major investments in quality of place. And I want to touch very quickly on some of those issues as well. The new economy. This is the 30 years after World War II, when the rising tide lifted all boats. The poorest 20% of Americans more than doubled their incomes in those 30 years after the war. We emerged out of World War II, the sole economic power on the planet. All of our potential competitors were decimated by the war effort. We put all of our technological developments for the war effort into commercial ventures. The 38% of the jobs in America were union jobs. The unions could negotiate with the corporations to ensure that workers shared in the prosperity of the companies. And the average American man, during this 30-year period after World War II, literally doubled his income, making twice as much money 20 years by 1970 than he was making in 1950. And those were the years, of course, when we celebrated the stay-at-home housewife mother in suburbia. The average American woman gave birth to 3.6 children in that incredible period between 1946 and 1964 when the baby boom was launched upon the land. I'll come back to the baby boom in a little while, because that has a lot to do with the demographics of the 21st century. But this is the last quarter century, when virtually all the benefits of economic growth have gone to the richest 5%, most of that to the richest 1%, much of that to the richest 0.1%, in a striking redistribution of earnings out of the hands of the poor and the middle class into the hands of the rich and the super rich in a way that we have never seen before in American history, with the sole exception of 1928. Just before the total collapse of the economy in the Great Depression. Why did this happen? Two basic reasons. One is, of course, globalization. Fareed Zakaria, the great newscaster and writer in a book called The Post-American Century, said it isn't a question of the decline of the West. The West is not declining. Our schools are not getting worse. They are better. Our kids are learning more in school today than you and I learned when we were of that age. Education, the West is not declining. It's not the decline of the West. It's the rise of the rest. We are in a global economy. Companies can now produce goods anywhere, sell them everywhere. If you are doing a job that I can train a third world worker to do, and I pay that third world worker $10 a day to do that job, I'm not going to pay you $10 an hour. And if you are doing a job that I can program a computer to do, I'm going to replace your job with an intelligent machine. We are in a radically different world where education, that was always a nice thing to have, has become absolutely essential to the opportunities for individuals to acquire the skills that will enable them to earn enough money to support a family in the knowledge economy of the 21st century. It is something new under the sun, and it is a new reality that is going to be with us forever. The good, in Houston, the great jobs in the 1970s was Hughes Tool Company, Cameron Ironworks, good blue-collar jobs. Those jobs are gone. And there are great shortages of skilled welders, skilled technicians. The requirement now to earn enough money to support a family is education beyond high school, 1 or 2 years in a community college. And I just want to show you a few quick examples of the new realities. This is participation in the workforce without a high school diploma. The unemployment rate in 2011 was 15%, dropping down to just 5% for those with bachelor's degrees. Participation in the workforce goes from 45% to 70%. From now on, if you drop out of high school, if you graduate from high school with a high school diploma and no special skills as a performer or an artist or an athlete, and just say, put me to work, America, I'm ready to work hard, you will probably not find a job. And if you find a job, it will not pay a living wage. And that's the great challenge of the new reality. Growing inequality is predicated above all else on access to quality education. The public understands this. We asked the question in our survey this year, for a person to be successful in today's world, is it necessary to get education beyond high school, or are there many ways to succeed with no more than a high school diploma? 75% of Houstonians and Americans recognize 2 years at least after high school, the most important institution of higher education in all of our cities is not, as in Houston, it's not Rice University, the great, wonderful as Rice is, it's the community college system. That's where we take kids coming out of high school with no skills and connect them to the technical jobs of the 21st century. And so the rising tide no longer lifts all boats. I want to give one quick example of that. This is the unemployment rates in Harris County in each of the years of our surveys. This was the collapse of the oil boom, and then a slight recovery in 84, and then the real depths of the recession, and then recovery, and then another recession. And then in the last 4 years, unemployment was at 4.3% in 2008, went to 6.6%, 8.6% of the depths of the current economic recession of 2010, and then dropped to 8.4, 7.3, 6.8. We in Houston congratulate ourselves on having this wonderful economy. We dropped a full percentage point below the national average. Forbes magazine chose Houston last year as the coolest city in America, and they did that in July of last year. So Houstonians are all saying how great everything is. When you ask people in the privacy of their homes, how are you experiencing your life? You get a very different picture. Here's very quickly one quick example. This is how do you think you'll be doing financially three or four years down the road? Think you'll be doing better, about the same, or worse? Percentage said, I'm going to be doing better, dropped to 21% at the depths of the recession, 28%, and then with this tremendous economic boom in Houston, quote unquote, no improvement whatsoever in the percent saying they've been doing better, and a drop in the percent who thought they would be doing better 3 or 4 years down the road. The rising tide no longer lifts all boats. In boomtown Houston, quote unquote, 1/4 of all our respondents said they had difficulty buying the groceries to feed their family in the last year. No change, no improvement at all, even as the economy has improved. Macroeconomic indicators don't tell you how people are doing in a world where the gap is growing and where education is such a critical determinant of opportunity to succeed. And not surprisingly, we're in a world now where people can lose their jobs and fall by the wayside, quote unquote, through no fault of their own. Their jobs disappear, global economic forces. There is, even in red state Texas and Houston, growing support for the belief that government has a role to play in protecting people who are falling through the cracks through no fault of their own. Question we've asked over the years, do you think welfare benefits generally give poor people a chance to get started again, or do they encourage poor people to stay poor and dependent? Percentage say they give poor people a chance to get started has gone up higher than ever before. Government has a responsibility to help reduce the inequalities in America has also gone up from 51 to 58%. Which of these statements come closest to your view? Government should do more to solve the country's problems, or government is trying to do too many things that should be left to individuals and businesses? Government needs to do more to solve the problems. It's an interesting kind of recognition, not dramatic, it's only 50%, but it's a growing sense that in today's world, we look to government for the support, for the investments that are critical in positioning Houston and Texas and America for success in the 21st century. So theme number one is growing inequalities predicated above all else on access to quality education. Theme number two is these quality of life issues. Houston has been making all kinds of efforts to turn itself, you know, we are a flat, hot, ugly city. Who cares if it smells? It's a smell of money down there. Suddenly trying to reinvent itself in a whole variety of different ways and making some real progress. I'm going to touch on just one thing that's particularly interesting and that has international and national implications, and it's particularly interesting in Houston. Houston is the most spread out, least dense, most automobile-dependent city in America. The city of Houston covers 600 square miles. This is the city of Houston. You know how big that is? You could put inside the city limits of Houston, Texas, simultaneously, I kid you not, the cities of Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Detroit. Those four cities fit inside the city limits of Houston, a city totally built on the basis of the automobile. And the greater Houston metropolitan area, the CMSA that the census defines as the Houston metropolitan area, covers a geographical space of 10,000 square miles. That is almost as large as the entire state of Massachusetts, and it is considerably larger than the state of New Jersey. This is the blob that ate East Texas. Houston was built on a crummy little bayou, 50 miles from any natural barrier in any direction. I mean, what is so wonderful about being here is the mountains. And the, there is nothing. It's a treeless prairie, a developer's dream, built by, for, and on behalf of the automobile, made possible by air conditioning, and the city spread everywhere. And we have been asking people, and so the result is that this is, as I say, the most automobile-dependent city. Wherever you go, wherever you live, the way you get from one place to another is by automobile. And we ask people, if you could live any way that you wanted in Houston, what would you prefer? And here's just one example. Would you prefer to live in a single-family home with a big yard where you would need to drive almost everywhere you'd need to go, or a smaller home in a more urbanized area within walking distance of shops and workplaces, which virtually doesn't exist. It's beginning to exist in Houston. But basically, so we asked this in 2008, and 36%, which was a big surprise, that said, I actually prefer to live in a more walkable, urbanist kind of place. In 2010, 39%, and the last time we asked the survey last year, 51%. What is happening across the board, and it's particularly interesting in cities that were built by the automobile, is that more and more of us are saying, wait a minute, this is not really, that this doesn't fit my life in the way that I thought it was going to, or the way that it did 20 and 30 years ago. When we all went out to the suburbs with our cars, two-thirds of all American families had children living at home. Today, less than a third of all American families have children living at home. One-fifth of all American adults live alone, live by themselves. Incredibly large numbers of empty nesters, right? The kids have grown up. I'm in my 40s and 50s. I work downtown. Do I still want to commute 2 hours every day? Do I still want to mow the lawn? And then large numbers of the creative class, the young people, the dinks, right? Double income, no kids. And they're postponing having kids. The sociologists talk about it's really, they're working very hard down there. It's D-I-N-S. Double income, no sex. And so all of a sudden, there is growing interest in alternative ways of living in cities. And it's especially, as I say, interesting in Houston. And Houston has been doing a whole bunch of things. The other piece of this is that all cities are now making investments in downtown and turning what have been abandoned areas into new attractive places. And Houston is no exception. This is the east side of downtown in Houston, Texas, in 1978. Nothingness, right? You work downtown, but you left to go home in the suburbs, and speculators had bought up the land waiting for the price to go up, and of course 4 years later comes the great oil bust of 1982-83, collapse of the economy. This is the exact same picture 33 years later. And here is a park, state-of-the-art sports venues, a large convention center, luxury, upscale apartments. Suddenly there's a downtown, and suddenly people are beginning to recognize the new demands that are there in cities across the country. And so again, we're watching the cities reinventing themselves, because the source of wealth for Houston and American cities in the 21st century has less and less to do with natural resources and more to do with human resources. These cities succeed if they are able to attract the best and the brightest people working at the cutting edge of knowledge, able to put their knowledge into commercial ventures. The resource of the knowledge economy is housed between the ears of the best and the brightest people in America who can live anywhere. And suddenly, quality of life issues that were never important, certainly not in Houston, have become central to the prospects of a city to succeed in attracting the talent that will grow the businesses of the 21st century and the global economy that is the world that we've now been rapidly moving into. So I tell people, boy, if that's all that was happening, that's enough to keep sociologists sort of interested in, especially in Houston, a 19th century business-oriented city, gradually, slowly, reluctantly, but unmistakably coming to grips with the challenges of the 21st century. But at this very same moment, of course, has come this fundamental, irreversible transformation in the ethnic composition of the Houston, the Texas, and the American population. Why here? Why now? Well, transition into the demographic revolution. Here is the number of immigrants coming to America in each of the decades from the 1820s to 2000. So let me just take a moment to look at this with you. Here, we won our independence from the Brits, and then in the 1840s came this terrible disaster in Europe where 1 million people in that country died, 1 million immigrated, 2 million were left in the country. the great potato famine, the Irish pouring into America. I need not remind you what we thought of the Irish. We thought they were a whole other species. They were Catholics instead of Protestants, and there were signs everywhere, Irishmen need not apply. And then along came some Germans and some French, and then there's a little dip here with the Civil War, another big dip with the Great Recession of 1890, 1897. 15.9 million immigrants were pouring into America between 1890 and 1914, coming from Europe, but not coming from where real Americans were supposed to come, Northern Europe. They were coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, and they weren't Protestants. They were Catholics and Jews, and they're coming to take our jobs and destroy our country. We've got to stop them. And in 1924, Congress enacted this incredible law, one of the most viciously racist laws that Congress has ever passed, the National Origins Quota Act, that said, okay, from now on, you can come to this country in direct proportion to which your ethnicity was and nationality was represented in the census of 1890 to give major preference to Northern Europeans. It used the new science of psychology and the IQ test to declare in the act, science has proven that there are three subspecies of the white race. The Nordics, who are biologically and intellectually superior to the Alpines, who in turn are superior to the Mediterraneans, and all of them are superior to the Jews and the Asians. And the law codified the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the Gentlemen's Agreement with Japan of 1906, to declare in the act, Asians are an inferior subspecies of humanity, ineligible from ever becoming American citizens, and Asians were banned entirely from coming to America. Isn't that incredible? This is us speaking out of the racist world of the 20s and 30s. And it was a law of the land through the 30s and 40s and 50s, could not survive the shifts of consciousness with the civil rights movements of the late 50s, our competition with the Soviet Union for the hearts and minds of third world countries, and above all, Kennedy's assassination. Kennedy had written a very powerful book called Immigrant America, and we said, you know, we've got to get rid of this terrible law. And in 1965, Congress changed the law. We used to be a racist nation. We're not racist anymore. We're going to give every country recognized by the UN 20,000 visas a year, regardless of their ethnicity or nationality. So get off my back. We're not racist. But we'll continue the hallmark of American immigration policy, which is family reunification. Right? American policy is in the business of reuniting families. If you're the father, mother, sister, brother, son, or daughter of an American citizen, you can come to the head of the line. Therefore, said Congress, nothing's going to change. Immigration, anyway, is a thing of the past. We're just going to get rid of this deeply embarrassing racist law. And if people do come, we're giving preference to those who are related to people who are already here in America. So nothing will change. Then it added another provision. It said, well, if you're a professional of exceptional ability, or if you have skills that are demonstrably needed in the short supply, you too can come to the head of the line. And in its debates, Congress was saying, we need to open the door for some more British doctors, some more German engineers. It never occurred to anyone, literally, that there were going to be African doctors, Indian engineers, Chinese computer programmers who would be able for the first time in the 20th century to come to America. The law was changed in 1965 and called one of the great inadvertent acts that the U.S. Congress has ever passed, in a body, of course, known for its inadvertent acts and its unintended consequences. The world changed totally unexpectedly. During the 1960s, about 3.5 million immigrants came to this country. Only 38% were coming from Europe. I meant to remind us from the beginning that between 1492 and 1965, 82% of all the human beings on the face of this earth who came to these shores came from Europe. Another 12% were Africans, originally brought here as slaves to serve the Europeans. And there's a handful of Chinese and Japanese working as farmers and laborers in California and Hawaii. This nation, throughout all of our history, had been an amalgam of European nationalities and is now becoming a microcosm of the world. What happened in the 1960s was 3.5 million came, only 18% now were from Europe. In the 1970s, about 5 million immigrants came, only 18% were Europeans. In the 1980s, about 9 million came, 1990s and 2000s, about 10 million immigrants per decade coming, 82% coming from Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Caribbean. And the United States, as I think about all of our history, the amalgam of European nationalities, is becoming the world's first universal nation, the first nation in the history of the world that can say, we are a free people, and we come from everywhere. And it's a truly remarkable transformation. At the same moment as the American economy is becoming fully integrated, as we were talking about, into a single world, global economic system, America, a microcosm of the world, ready to build the bridges to the global economy. Immigration is network-driven, so it's not happening at the same rate everywhere in the country. There are two cities, Los Angeles and New York, that are still the great immigration capitals of America. Still today, about one-third of all the foreign-born residents of the United States live in or around those two great cities, Los Angeles and New York, followed by lesser magnet gateway cities, Miami, San Francisco, Chicago, Houston, followed right after Houston by San Diego, Washington, D.C., Dallas, Boston, Atlanta, spreading out to every city and town across America. As it turns out, no city has been transformed as fully, as completely, as suddenly, as unexpectedly, as irreversibly as Houston, Texas. Here are the census figures for Harris County, which is where Houston is located. In the first three decades, Houston was a biracial southern city, dominated and controlled in an automatic, taken for granted way by white men. 74% of us in 1960 were Anglos. 20% African Americans, just 6% Hispanics, less than 0.5% were Asians. During the oil boom years of the 60s and 70s, it was Anglos pouring into Houston because that's where the jobs were. By 1980, Houston had become the fourth largest city in America, having surpassed Philadelphia, still a basically Anglo city, 63% Anglo, now 20% African American, 16% Latino, 22% Asian. The Anglo population grew by 27% between 1970 and 1980. Then came the oil bust of 1982, when the oil boom collapsed, just as the rest of the country was coming out of its stagflating 70s, and Anglos stopped coming to Houston. And all the growth of this most rapidly growing city in America has been non-Anglo growth. And this biracial southern city dominated by white men has become the single most ethnically diverse city in America. Harris County today is now just 33% Anglo. Anglo is our Texas term for non-Hispanic white, European American. 18% African American, 41% Latino, 8% Asian. The cities that are succeeding in America today are the cities that have attracted immigration. The cities that are losing out, that are losing their status as major cities in the country, are those cities that are beginning to lose population for one reason or another, because Asians have not been pouring into those cities the way they have to these other cities. So Philadelphia, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Detroit, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Buffalo are all cities losing population. Houston is one of the vibrant, rapidly growing cities in America purely because of the tremendous energy, vitality, commitment to hard work of immigrants pouring into the city from Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Caribbean. No city has benefited more from immigration than Houston, Texas. And it's not surprising, it's ironic, but not surprising that there's anti-immigrant attitudes in Houston when you think how much that city has benefited from this kind of growth. And here are the other most ethnically diverse cities around or metropolitan areas in the country. Here's New York, Los Angeles, Washington, Dallas. Houston, we claim, is the most ethnically diverse but there are a lot of different measures of diversity. The one that we claim is how close do you get to 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%? How close are you to equal divisions among the four great communities of America? And by that measure, Houston is the most ethnically diverse. We beat out New York because New York has too many Anglos. We beat out Los Angeles because it has very few African Americans. We beat out Miami because it has very few Asians. Houston is one of those places where the four communities come together in greater equality. All of us, we now know, minorities. All of us called on to build something new under the sun, a truly successful, inclusive, equitable, united, multi-ethnic society that will be Houston and Texas and America in the 21st century. Here's just one quick picture of Harris County to give you a sense of what we've been experiencing with all this suddenness. This is Harris County in 1980. The census tracts that are predominantly Anglo are in blue. The census tracts that are in red are predominantly African American. The census tracts in orange are predominantly Latino. This is in 1980. And then a very few places in olive where there's no majority. Okay, so this is Harris County in 1980. This is Harris County in 1990. Latinos spreading north and east and now surrounding the inner city, more and more of these census tracts with no majority. Here it is in 2000, and here it is today. you know, there it is. It is the destiny of cities like Houston to be at the forefront of the demographic trends. You know, no one consulted with me before all these people came. Why is this happening? There it is, right? And here's a picture of Houston by age as well as by ethnicity. This, we go from babies over here to older folks over there, and here is where Anglos are found in the census of 2010. It's only among Houstonians over the age of 65 that a majority of people are still Anglos. And you can see this is, I mentioned the baby boom, right? Between 1946, right after World War II, when we were the sole economic power on the planet, moving into this incredible world of broad-based economic prosperity for the next 50 years, for the next 30 years, from 1940 to 1970, basically. Between 1946 and 1964, 76 million babies were born. The average American woman giving birth to 3.6 children. 76 million, preceded and followed by baby bus generations. So for 60 years, it's been this bulge going through the system. Demographers talk about it like a pig being swallowed by a python. Not very healthy, they tell us, either for the pig or the python. The leading edge of those 76 million babies turned 66 this year. And we are going to watch a literal doubling in the number of Americans over the age of 65 in the next 25 years. The fastest growing age segment today of all Americans is men and women over the age of 85. Next fastest is 60. There will be a doubling of people over the age of 65. And they are overwhelmingly Anglos because they were the ones to have been born here between 1946 and 1964. It was not until 1965 when, for the first time in the 20th century, large numbers of non-Europeans were allowed to come to America. And you migrate when you're a young man or woman looking for new opportunities for your family. So the young people across America are disproportionately non-Anglo, as the older folks are disproportionately Anglo. Nowhere is that clearer than Houston, because Houston is a city of migrants. We were a city of Anglo migrants during the oil boom years, and then, as I mentioned, for the last 30 years, a city of non-Anglo migrants. And here's where all the rest of Houston is found, right? And if you go to the children under the age of 18, of all the children of Houston, 51% are Latino kids, 19% are African-American, 70% of the children of Houston are African-American and Latino. The two groups overwhelmingly the most likely to be living in poverty. 80% of all the kids in HISD, the Houston Independent School District, 80% qualify for reduced cost of free lunch programs. We know what poverty does to your ability to succeed in the public schools. And it's a safe statement to make that if Houston's African-American or Latino young people are unprepared to succeed in the knowledge economy of the 21st century, it is hard to envision a prosperous future for Houston, as it is for America as a whole. That's who we are and will be as the 21st century unfolds. And I tell people, you know, okay, build your fence, close off immigration, not another immigrant ever again will be allowed to come to these shores. 60 and 70-year-old Anglos are not going to be making a whole lot more babies. I tell you, we'll do the best we can. We'll work on it every chance we get. You can go to the bank on this. No force in the world is going to stop Houston or Texas or America from becoming more Latino, more African-American, more Asian, and less Anglo as the 21st century unfolds. Nothing in the world can stop that. So the only question that our generation has been given, okay, how do we make this work? How do we ensure that this ethnic diversity can be the great asset for cities and for a country like America, positioning itself in the global economy as a microcosm of the world? And how do we make sure it doesn't end up tearing us apart and becoming a major liability, reducing rather than enhancing our competitiveness in the global economy? So this is Houston today. This is the United States today. Still overwhelmingly Anglo. And it's not until you reach children under the age of 5 across America that for the first time you find equality. In fact, about a month and a half ago, the census announced we now know that at the under the age of 5, more people are non-Anglo than Anglo. Right? So it's already begun. And all the older folks disproportionately, as we were saying, this is the United States today, and this is the projection of the United States in 2050. So it's Houston and Los Angeles and Chicago and Washington today. Right? So these are the cities where the American future is going to be worked out. And it's an enormously interesting moment where all of us know the absolute inevitability of this process. Psychologists talk about something called the psychology of inevitability. If something is happening in my life in general that I don't particularly approve of, I'm not happy about, no one consulted with me before this happened, but I'm finally become convinced it's happening, there's nothing I can do to stop it. It tends to trigger in the human psyche a rethinking. Well, maybe this is not such a terrible thing. Maybe there's some positive things that have come. Maybe I can make money off of this. Maybe we can build something new. And you begin to see this across the country. And we're seeing it in Houston. Questions we've asked over the years that have shown increasingly positive views of this ethnic diversity. This is three questions we've asked. We asked this year, each one of which is now at a higher level than it's ever been. Should we admit more the same number or fewer immigrants in the next 10 years as we admitted in the last 10? The percent saying no, virtually no one says more, but the percent not saying fewer has jumped from 55 to 68%. Are you in favor or opposed to granting a path to legal citizenship for illegal immigrants who speak English and have no criminal record? Went from 64 to 66 to 71 to 74 to 83% across the board in the surveys this year. Again, identical questions asked in exactly the same location in the questionnaire, of samples drawn exactly the same way. And then, do you think the new immigration into America today mostly strengthens American culture or mostly threatens American culture? And the percent saying it strengthens American culture jumped from 47 to 61%. Several things going on here, I think, that are really powerful. One is we've had 30 years now to get used to the idea of being a nation of immigrants again. The story of America is that we have always felt the last wave of immigrants were great. This wave is destroying the country. Right? We certainly thought that way when the Italians and the Greeks and the Poles came in those great numbers at the turn of the century, when we passed that incredibly racist law to stop them from coming again. And now here we are, a city, a nation of immigrants again. So it's not surprising that it takes a while to get used to that idea, but we're getting used to it. And we're beginning to recognize the tremendous contributions that immigrants make to the communities in which they go. And the third real factor is that the great press of immigration into America has ended. 2007 was a time when the greatest number of immigrants coming, that greatest sense we all had of being overwhelmed by these people coming in here and not speaking our language and having different values and some of them breaking our laws to get here. And that great press of immigration has ended. The Pew Research Center announced about 8 months ago that for the first time in 35 years, all their estimates tell them more Mexicans left the United States to go back to Mexico during the year 2011, than left Mexico to come to the United States. Several things going on there. One is, of course, we beefed up the borders tremendously. We were in a recession, so there were really very few jobs. And Mexico is doing remarkably well. It is growing faster than the United States. And the demographics of Mexico, we still think sort of Mexican women as having all these babies. Well, back in 1960, the average Mexican woman had 6.3 children on average. Today, the average Mexican woman has 2.2 children. Just striking kind of shit. So all that great pressure of unemployed people coming into the cities and not being able to find a job and having to go to El Norte is much, much less. So there's less anxiety, less fear, more recognition that this is what America is going to be in the 21st century, and we're more prepared, I think, we've been a very long time to sort of say, okay, embracing it and saying, let's go forward, let's see how we can make this work and build the new America of the 21st century. And I want to put one other piece on the table, and then I'll stop and we can open it to questions and thoughts, and that is that the single most powerful predictor among Anglos of comfort with diversity in all the different ways that we've been trying to measure it is age. And here's one sort of fun question that reminds us of what's going on here. We asked Anglos, have you ever been involved in a romantic relationship with someone who's not Anglo? And of Anglos in Houston, this is, right, under the age of 50, 50 to 57% said, thank you for asking. Yes, indeed, I have. And then here it is for us older Anglos. And what this is a reminder of is how radically different the world is that young people have been growing up in, compared to the world that most of us grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, right? And there's a fundamental law of human nature that says what I am familiar with feels right and natural, and what I'm unfamiliar with feels unnatural and somehow not quite right. And so it's not surprising every question we ask, I'm just going to give a few examples of questions from this year's survey.
This is Anglos in, under the age of 1829, 30, 44, and then 60 and older. Do you think the increasing ethnic diversity in Houston brought about by immigration is on balance a good thing or a bad thing? The percent saying it's a good thing, 71% among Anglos under 30, 48% only of Anglos over 60. You in favor opposed to a path to legal citizenship for illegal immigrants who speak English and have no criminal record? Was 74% for Anglos under 30, dropping to 55% for those of us over 60. I remind you that 60, you know, what is that? 55%. That's not bad. That's, we can learn. We are older Anglos, right? And then the increase in immigration into the U.S. today mostly strengthens rather than threatens American culture. 68% of Anglos under 30 say it mostly strengthens American culture, and 65% of Anglos over 60 say it mostly threatens American culture. So it's a reminder of this remarkable moment, right? We are living at a time of fundamental transformation when the world that that younger Anglos are growing up in is just a different world with a different set of expectations than the world that most of us grew up in, 15 and 20 and 50 years ago. And it's a reminder of this challenge of coming to grips with the remarkable changes in Houston and America. And so just to remind us then, this new economy is one where if we're going to make it, the United States has to nurture a far more educated workforce. We've got to find ways to ensure that the children of America are prepared to make out in a global economy competing on the basis of brains, on the basis of skills, on the basis of the best kind of education that is available on this planet, and invest in the research initiatives that will fuel the new economies of the 21st century. Cities across America will have to become more attractive urban destinations, accommodating the rapid growth that will occur in cities, and that's why I think it's particularly interesting to see this new interest among large numbers of Americans in living lives that are no longer so totally dependent on the automobile, which provides opportunities to accommodate more people without further destroying the environment. We're looking in Houston, there are going to be another 20 million people, we think, moving into Harris County, Texas in the next 20 years. Where are they going to live? And who can doubt that if we don't find a way to accommodate the interest in urban opportunities and we make everybody go out into the suburbs with automobiles, that the last remaining green spaces would be turned into parking lots and subdivisions, and traffic will get worse and worse. And how do we accommodate increased numbers of people in our communities and have a greener, healthier, more beautiful place with more people in it only by some new thinking? And then, of course, finally, this remarkable, absolutely extraordinary transformation that we're in the midst of, and called on to do something that has never been done before. No history, there's no example anywhere on the planet, in any of our history, as far as I know, of building a truly successful world made up of all the peoples of the world, of all the religions of the world, into a single nation that respects and honors and opens opportunities for everyone. So it's a truly remarkable moment, I think, in the Houston and the American history. I want to end this with those two sources of wisdom from ancient China. Right? One is that famous Chinese curse. In the old days in China, when you were angry at someone, people would say, "Darn you, may you live in interesting times," meant as a curse. I don't think there have ever been more interesting times than right here and right now. And then there's that wonderfully insightful way that the Chinese language renders the word for crisis. The word for crisis in Chinese is weiji, consists of two characters, one signifying danger, and the other, opportunity. Not a bad way to think about this remarkable coming together of forces, a set of cards that this generation has been dealt. No one planned for Houston and America to go into recession after that great economic expansion of the post-war period and then emerge into a radically different kind of economy where education has become so absolutely critical, where quality of life issues are now central to the city's success as they compete for the talent of the 21st century. And no one, as we know, planned for this ethnic transformation to take place. Here it is. These are the cards that this generation has been dealt. How we play those cards, with what kind of wisdom, sensitivity, determination to seize the opportunities and derail the dangers, will be the measure of the kind of city, the kind of state, the kind of country that we build together in the 21st century. Thank you all very, very much. Great honor and pleasure to be here. Thank you. Time for questions.
Well, we're waiting for the questions to come forward. Could you comment on the difference in attitudes of the immigrant populations that are coming into this country from those that existed with the European culture that was established.
As I mentioned, there's a lot of similarities. This new immigration is not that different from that immigration that we knew 50 years ago, but it's different in a variety of ways. The biggest difference, I think, is that when the Italians and the Greeks and the Poles came, they came as peasants. They came with a fifth-grade education. But they were coming into a country in 1900 where the average education of the average Anglo was eighth grade. They were coming into a country in 1900 that was just beginning a vigorous century of blue-collar industrial expansion. When you went from unskilled to semi-skilled to skilled industrial work, the rule of thumb in immigration, when we studied immigration back in the 60s, looking at that previous period, was you had three or four generations to go from peddler to plumber to professional. Today, the blue-collar pathway has disappeared. The ladder of mobility, where the first immigrant was a peasant in New York City. The son got a little bit of education and then apprenticed himself as an electrician or a plumber. The grandson finished high school and became shop steward or foreman in a union. And the great-grandson went to college. We have to now, with the Latino peasants who are coming here with an eighth-grade education into a world where so many people now have education beyond high school, we have to, in one generation, figure out a way to take these kids who are children of often parents with very little education themselves, no clue how to help their kids succeed in public schools. We have to figure out a way to ensure that they can make it through high school, get 1 or 2 years in the community college, or else they will come out into the American workforce and discover there are no better jobs for them than the jobs their immigrant parents had 20 years earlier. It's a reason why it's such a centrally important, kind of urgent issue that we have to address in this generation. And the kids can learn, we've got to make the investments to make it possible for them to do it. But it's a new economy where the blue-collar pathways have disappeared.
We have a lot of questions related to education.
Okay.
You stressed it in your presentation. How do we get there? And given the budgetary constraints, and at what levels do we do it? Is it early childhood? Is it the seniors that need the education? Could you comment on your thoughts and the road to take?
Yeah, I think as we take seriously the fact that we are now in a knowledge economy, and this is something new under the sun, right? The source of wealth, certainly in Houston we feel it, the source of wealth in Houston had nothing to do with education. You didn't need money. You didn't need education to make money in Texas. You made money by land, by exploiting all the things you could do on the land, cotton, timber, cattle, oil. The source of wealth in the 21st century is knowledge. It is no longer natural resources, it is human resources. So we have got to turn ourselves into a learning society across the board, from preschool through a lifetime. One of the things, we're talking about this longevity that we're living. I tell my students, you graduate from Rice University at the age of 21. You have 60 years of vigorous adult life ahead of you. What are you going to do with those 60 years? And the old argument that I grew up with, the old notion that the one life, one career imperative. You decide what you're going to do at the age of 21, and you do that nonstop full-time until you're 65, and then retire with a pension. Not the 21st century. Sociologists think the average college graduate today will have 4 to 5 career changes before he or she finally retires in the late 70s or early 80s. Right? We're moving into a world of where learning will be continual and lifelong. And one of the things I'm so impressed with in this particular spot is that this is a learning society. I mean, I visited that fantastic library of yours. You've got these steamboats. This is, you get it. I mean, this is a place where learning goes on and needs to go on across the board. Starting with preschool, I think preschool is probably the most critical thing that we have not been doing. Kids at age 2 are basically the same. And then us middle class parents make sure our kids get quality preschool education. For 2 or 3 years, the ages of 3, 4, 5, before they start kindergarten, kids who don't get that start kindergarten 1.5 or 2 years behind, and they never catch up. And universal access to quality preschool may be the single best investment we could make in the American future. And that's, but education needs to go on across the board, and it's really where what it means to be in the 21st century knowledge economy that is now the world that we will know for as far as the future can foresee. Another question.
You This questioner would like to have your comments on the current immigration bill and how you think it's going to impact this future that you've described.
You bet. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, what we have now is an absolutely horrible system, right? We have 10 to 11 million people who are here in the shadows. And why are they here? Because for 30 years, we have not allowed enough immigrants to come here legally to do the jobs that our economy desperately needed to have done by people who desperately needed to do them. If you're a Mexican worker in Mexico and you don't have family in the United States and you don't have professional skills and you want to come and work in construction or in a nanny or elder care or daycare, and you say, I want to wait in line, there is no line. Literally, there's no possible. It's something like 28 years. And so for all practical purposes, there's no way you can get here legally. So we have now 11 million people here, many for 20, 25 years, who men who can be cheated out of their wages, women who can be attacked and raped, children terrified there may be a raid on Shipley's Donuts and my mother won't be there when I come back from school. We've got to regularize that process. And we're finally at a point, I think, after 35 years, where comprehensive immigration reform is going to be possible. It's for all the reasons we were talking about, and it's also the political realities. I didn't mean to want to talk about politics, but one very interesting datum from the last election, Mitt Romney won 60% of the white vote across the country. That would have elected him president 8 years ago. It cannot win election today, right? He lost 71% of the Latino vote, 73% of the Asian vote, and 94% of the African-American vote. And the Republican Party is getting the message, although it's hard to penetrate fully, getting the message that you can't be the anti-immigrant party and expect to win national elections. And so you can see a kind of a movement in the Republican Party and this bipartisan proposal that has come out of the Senate is now in the House, is the best chance we've had in 35 years to have rational immigration policies.
One of the demographic shifts that you talked about was generational. And could you tell us what your studies have shown about the difference in attitudes between the various generations and how that's impacting our society?
Right, I talked a little bit about this striking degree to which age predicts Anglo attitudes. But I talked about the fact that we're in a world of continual learning and continual growth and the old inoculation theory, you know, you got educated in college and then you're educated, no longer works, we keep learning, and so older folks are shifting their attitudes and younger people are moving. So the generational shifts are not as dramatic, I think, in most other areas as they are in this one particular area where it's a reminder of how different the demographic world was that us older Anglos grew up in than the world of the 1990s and 2000s that younger Anglos are coming of age. But in general, the generational shift in America is a shift not only by age, but also by socioeconomic status and also by ethnicity. And so one of the great challenges for us is to make the investments in kids who don't look like me, right? Kids who are coming from different backgrounds, who are the Americans of the 21st century, but I've already educated my kids and will we find a way to come together in investing in the American future? And large part of that means investing in the young people who will obviously be the future for all. And it's a future that is not going to look like the past that us older Anglos grew up in and took for granted. But as I say, you see less, you know, all of our surveys keep showing increasing enlightenment, if that's a word, among older Anglos who just sort of recognize this and see it and are increasingly comfortable with it. And the great fear in America has always been the secession of the fortunate fifth, that the 20% of us who are incredibly fortunate in America and have gotten the best educations that you can get on this planet, have been enormously successful, the great fear is that they will secede. They will go off into gated communities in the suburbs with their private security, their private police force, their private country clubs, and say to the rest of the city, the state, and the country, don't raise my taxes and build more prisons. And locking out the opportunities for poor people to get the education they need. We are not seeing that. our surveys. Older folks are not seceding in that way. And it's, I think, one of the great sources of optimism that one can have about who we are as Americans and how we're responding to this truly remarkable world that none of us planned for, none of us asked for, none of us said, yes, I want this. All of us said, wait a minute, why is this happening? But here it is. And like so many of these things, it can turn into a tremendous asset, a tremendous positive thing for this country if we manage it right, if we make the right investments.
Your surveys indicate that the Hispanic populations and the non-Anglos have very progressive attitudes, more progressive than the Anglos. Yet in Texas, it appears that there is a conservative bent that does not reflect these attitudes. Could you reconcile this disparity?
Right. There's several things to point to here. One is, what we are doing is asking about public opinion. We are asking people in the privacy of their homes, how do you see the world? And when you do that, you get much more progressive views. You know, the classic example is gun control. We asked the question, because we had to in the survey this year, about are you in favor or opposed to requiring a background check on all gun sales? Who could be against that? 89% are in favor. You cannot get that through the Congress. There's a difference between public opinion and politically effective opinion. Who controls the agenda? Who contributes to congressional elections? Who do the congressmen need to listen to? Who votes above all else, right? And whose voices are heard in the political arena? And so it's a very important reminder that there's a big disjuncture. It's one of the failures of our democracy between public opinion and politically effective opinion. But ultimately, one senses public opinion will out, and you can begin to see those things begin to move in that direction. And then the other piece is who votes, as I say. And in Texas, Latinos, who are a very big percentage of the Latino of the Texas population, vote at half the rate that Latinos in California vote. And that has a lot to do with the different politics. But it also, you know, demography is destiny. There's a sense. So it's a fascinating. Texas, of all places, one of the reddest states, one of the most secure. There's not a single statewide Democrat in office on any statewide office whatsoever. For 30 years, there's been total dominance by Republicans. Both Republicans and Democrats are now beginning to look to Texas as potential, maybe not blue, but purple battleground state as we move forward. Because, and then what is the challenge for Republicans is that if they ever lose Texas, they will probably, at least for the foreseeable future, not be able to win national election. Because they will not win California. They're not going to win New York. Increasingly, they're not going to win Florida. Texas is the big enchilada. They lose Texas, and Texas goes Democrat. It's very hard to see how a Republican candidate for president can make it into the Oval Office. So it's a time when both parties are tremendously interested in what's going to happen over the next period of years. But it's been interesting to watch this process unfold as people vote in different ways and in different frequencies. And if you're an NRA person, you're going to vote on that issue of gun control, whereas those of us who are in favor of gun control are in favor of a whole lot of other things, and it's not the single issue that I'm going to vote on, and that too has a lot of effects on how public opinion gets translated into politically effective opinion.
Coming back to education, blending a couple of questions together. Have you had an opportunity to express your views on this to elected officials? And if so, what are their responses and how do they propose that these changes be funded?
Right. I mean, that's really the great question, isn't it? I mean, in this world, you know, someone once said that education is no panacea, but if we get it right, it's going to solve just about all of our problems. But how to get it right. Money is a factor, but it's not the only factor, maybe not even the most important factor. A lot has to do with reorganizing at the local level. A lot of it has to do with, as I mentioned, I think the single, when I get asked sometimes, if I could do, okay, Kleinberg, if you could wave your magic wand and do one thing that would change the trajectory of Houston, what would it be? And I now say, I would figure out a way to ensure universal access to quality preschool education, the ages of 2 and 6. And get that. And what I tell the business community is that that is as critical an infrastructure investment in the economic prosperity of the Houston region in the 21st century as dredging the ship channel was for the economic prosperity of Houston in the 20th century. When we turned Houston 50 miles from the ocean into the second largest port in the country, that was critical in the 20th century. This is the same kind of infrastructure investment in the resource that will build the economy of the 21st century. So what's the answer to education? It's happening every... Texas keeps cutting back on education. It's increasing a little bit now this year. It's adding back some of what it took away the previous... Texas is at the bottom of the 50 states in the percentage of adults with high school education, and it is 30th of the 50 states in the percentage with college education. That is state suicide. That state is not going to make it as a powerful state, a competitive state in the 21st century if it doesn't figure out a way to turn that around. And what I tell people in Houston is you got to stop looking to Washington, you got to stop looking to Austin, you have to look to what are the resources that we can bring to bear. And Houston turns out to be one of the places that is ground zero for educational reform. Incredibly successful charter schools, KIPP and YES schools. Houston has the largest Teach for America program of any major city in the country. It's got a whole new set of investments in turning around the worst performing elementary and middle and high schools in HISD. Trying, working very hard. Everybody knows how critically important education is. And private sectors are providing resources of various sorts. We have proven techniques that work. These kids coming to the KIPP and YES schools take the kids from the bottom of the socioeconomic status, all in abject poverty, and the requirement to graduate from those high schools is acceptance at a four-year university. And 95% graduate. It's just striking. It's not rocket science. They keep these kids until 5 o'clock every day. They have 3 weeks in the summer. They take them on college tours. The kids pick their college in kindergarten and sort of think about getting there. We can do this. We can do this. And it's really a question of resources of all sorts, not just monies, but also, you know, we need to throw money at these problems, but we really need to throw people at these problems. And another thing that us older folks can do is to get involved in reading and working with young kids in the schools and helping to change those trajectories that will make the difference for the long run.
Thank you very much for coming.